Morning, everyone. I guess we're going to get started. This morning, Dr. Yonkel Gershman is going to give us a talk on delirium in the medical hospital. Dr. Gershman received his medical degree from New York College of Osteopathic Medicine and completed his internship and residency in psychiatry in Zuckerberg Hillside Hospital, LIJ Health System, and he did a fellowship in psychiatry at Long Island Jewish Medical Center. His fellowship in hospital psychiatry, or was formerly called Consultation Liaison Psychiatry, Psychosomatic Medicine, and he's board certified in psychiatry. And he's going to give us a talk again this morning on delirium in the medical hospital.
All right. Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me okay? All right. So thank you for joining me at 7:30 about delirium. This is an exciting topic, mostly for psychiatrists and neurologists. And I like to share that my time with delirium in the day, it takes up about 70% of my day. And I'm half jokingly going to say it takes up 70% of your day, too. So we have quite a bit of content to get through. And this is kind of our list of what we're going to do: definition, epidemiology, risk factors, and etiology, neuropathogenesis, the financial impact and length of stay of delirium, morbidity and mortality, relationship to dementia, workup and treatment, and recovery. Delirium has many names. You've seen some of these names. You've used some of these names: altered mental status, acute brain failure, encephalopathy, acute confusional state, ICU psychosis, etc. These are all interchangeable names for delirium. Acute brain failure, I started for you because it's gaining momentum. We talk about heart failure, liver failure, kidney failure. Acute brain failure is a term that better explains to us and to patients and their families what is actually going on. Delirium is a term that originated from ancient Greek literature. It's been used for hundreds of years, and it's used in everyday conversations, which is a plus and a minus at the same time. But the brain is like another organ. According to the DSM-5, there needs to be three criteria: disturbance in attention, disturbance in awareness, it needs to develop over hours to days, and it's a change from baseline that fluctuates. Additional disturbances in cognition are necessary to make the diagnosis. To further understand delirium, I Googled different definitions, and this is what I got. And part of my argument will be that it means something different for everyone because we are not that good at defining it, because the concept and clinically, there's a gap. So Mayo Clinic believes that delirium is a serious disturbance in mental abilities that results in confused thinking and reduced awareness of your environment. A little bit vague. Webster believes that it's an acute mental disturbance characterized by, again, confused thinking and disrupted attention, and then it's also accompanied by disordered speech and hallucinations. Very general words. The Psychosomatic Medicine textbook, which is our Bible, it states that it's an acute and fluctuating disorder of consciousness, which means attention, awareness of self and environment, and wakefulness that results in neuropsychiatric symptoms. Then we use words like oriented times four to the situation. Consciousness, depending on how you use it, can mean awake or asleep. So the words are difficult. The words do not define necessarily the clinical phenomena that we see daily. One simple idea is that it's an acute change or change in mental status. But there are other psychiatric disorders that can present with acute change in mental status. Depression, schizophrenia, etc., sometimes can be seen as acute as well. So let's look specifically at the disorders of consciousness. Delirium has its place amongst these two. These words, vegetative state, minimally conscious state, are over 10 years old now at least, and also gaining momentum in how we describe consciousness. So just to go through each one a little bit, coma we are pretty familiar with, and there's a minus and a plus next to each word to denote if it's a yes or a no. So a coma, a patient is not aroused, they're not conscious, there's no sleep and wake cycle. Vegetative state, they are aroused, but they're not aware, and there is a sleep-wake cycle. Already getting a little bit confusing. Minimally conscious state, they are aroused, they're inconsistently following, there is a sleep-wake cycle, but there is no intent. Delirium, all the way at the bottom, has intent. And then there's normal. So there are funny mnemonics to memorize these. So coma, we know everyone's out. Vegetative state, we say that the lights are on, but no one's home. The minimally conscious state is someone's home, but they're not coming to the door. Delirium is where the lights are being flickered on and off and the door is being open and closed. And then there's normal. So this is your disorder of consciousness. So again, the findings in delirium are vague, and there is this disconnect between idea and what we see clinically. Let's look clinically at delirium. So there are diffuse cognitive deficits. And let's picture the patient while we do this. The patient is inattentive. They're disoriented to time, place, and person. They have impaired memory. They have visual constructional impairment, executive function impairment, and they have difficulty with abstracting. There is a temporal course clinically. It can be acute or abrupt onset. It can fluctuate over 24 hours. It is usually reversible. There's a subclinical syndrome that's coming out, a possible prodrome. It's hard to divide the two, but there's almost like a pre-delirium syndrome coming out in the literature now that doesn't technically meet the criteria, but already denotes that delirium is coming. And the subclinical syndrome, the second from the bottom, can also follow delirium. It's very hard to divide these clinically. We can define them in words, but it's hard to define them clinically. Delirious patients can have psychosis, perceptual disturbance, illusions, hallucinations of all five senses. They can have delusions where they're paranoid, they're often poorly formed, and they have a thought disorder where they are speaking tangentially, circumstantially, or have loosening of associations. There's a sleep-wake disturbance. They can have fragmented sleep. They can have a reversal of the normal cycle where they're sleeping during the day, or there's just overall sleeplessness. The motor behavior is what we call the delirium phenotype. It's how we denote what type of delirium we're seeing, but it's only one aspect of delirium. So there's the hyperactive, where the patient is punching, kicking, screaming, spitting. We identify that patient very well, and often nursing does for us. Hypoactive delirium, this is the delirium where the patient is not punching, kicking, and screaming. They're sitting there silently. And then there's the mixed, which is the most common. One thing to bring to your attention here is that in terms of numbers and occurrence, look how common hypoactive delirium is compared to hyperactive. And this is the one that's often missed because these are the patients that look depressed. They look sad. Of course, grandpa would be upset. He's in the hospital. He's looking out the window. He wants to be outside. But your hypoactive delirium numbers are pretty high as well. They have a language impairment. They have word-finding difficulty and paraphasias. They have comprehension deficits. They have altered semantic content. And when severe, they can even mimic expressive and receptive aphasia. In terms of their mood and their affect, any mood can occur, and it's often incongruent. Many times I get a consult for depression on a patient that I already see is post-op. Patient looks severely depressed walking into the room, and it's such a humbling answer when you ask a patient how they feel if they're depressed, and they say, I'm feeling great, but they look severely depressed. Often asking the patient how they feel will point out the incongruence. They can have anger or irritability. We spoke about hypoactive delirium, which is often labeled as depression. They can have lability with rapid shifts of emotion. And their mood component of delirium is not related to the mood preceding the delirium. So if a patient is coming in depressed and they look depressed after surgery, it doesn't mean that they are still depressed. It could mean that they have hypoactive delirium. Or irritability is another piece. Patient was always very difficult in life, and then after surgery, he's more intense. Well, he could be just upset, but he could also be delirious. He might not know the date anymore. There's fear, there's anxiety, and there's perplexity. So I guess one might say after hearing those last few slides that every symptom means delirium now. But this is a nice way that Jose Maldonado, who's the Delirium Society president, I think, still, and is a very big leader in delirium and consult liaison psychiatry, and we'll talk about him more as the lecture goes on. But this is one of his slides where it groups symptoms into clusters, and it might be a little bit of an easier way to define delirium. So we have your disturbance of cognition, we have your disturbance of circadian rhythm, we have disturbance of emotion, consciousness and attention, and disturbance of psychomotor activity. If you're seeing these, you might begin to think of delirium. And we look at these symptom clusters and then extrapolate backwards. Moving on to epidemiology. This is a very interesting slide for a hospital. It tells you the numbers for delirium by floor, by type of patient. So just, I'll give you a second just to look at it on your own, and then I'll point out a few things. So there is a frail elderly category, and studies isolate that as a separate population. That is our population. Frail elderly, 60%. I've joked with some of you that half of our hospitals delirious at any given time, also half jokingly. Look at advanced cancer. It has the highest number there, 85%. So our eighth floor, if you have a patient on the eighth floor or they have advanced cancer, it is most likely that they're delirious. MICU, 60 to 80%. HIV and AIDS, 40%. Cardiotomy, our CV, 50 to 67%. Seventh floor, all the way in the bottom, 65%. So the numbers are very high. Even general adults, which I guess as a psychiatrist, my day is biased, but our population, our average age in the hospital is 78. Statistically, it's 78. But look at general adults all the way on top, 10 to 24%. That's a lot for the general adult population. What if we look at the ER? ER shows 8 to 17%. Nursing homes, look at the numbers in nursing homes in terms of our patient population and where they are coming from. That means that the patient coming from a nursing home is most likely already delirious. What do patients get when they're agitated in the ER? Anyone? Haldol is the right answer, but not as what's going on. Ativan, that's right, okay. So you see where I'm going with this. So our nursing home population is coming in delirious. Our ER population is already delirious. And then we give Ativan when we're not sure what's medically going on. So moving on to risk factors and etiology. So the first three are really static risk factors. And everything else, the next few slides will be interchangeable between risk factors and etiology, because the points listed on the slides can either set you up for delirium or cause delirium themselves. So age over 75, a static risk factor, baseline cognitive dysfunction, male gender. Then we have the things that we can change: sensory impairment, use of IV lines, catheters, restraints, over-sedation, sleep deprivation, poorly controlled pain. UTI and pneumonia obviously are big ones for delirium. Hip fractures, hyper and hypothermia, hypotension, hypoperfusion, hypertension, hypertensive encephalopathy is associated with delirium. hypoxia, malnutrition, nutrition deficiency, B12 and folate. This is why I check B12 and folate on most people, because it can predispose you to delirium. I'm not trying to diagnose low B12 levels in the population. Metabolic encephalopathy. So patients with cardiac disease, hepatic disease, renal disease, MIs, PEs, they may not be directly connected to the brain, but our body communicates with itself. And patients often coming in already predisposed to delirium are at risk for developing delirium. Low albumin, elevated cortisol. We use albumin to tell how patients are doing and how it may perhaps suggest their recovery. Albumin is a big predictive factor for delirium as well. CNS pathology, direct pathology in the brain, trauma, medications, all types of medications are associated with delirium, including ones that I use, that we use, over-the-counter meds. A lot of our patients are using Tylenol PM and Benadryl to go to sleep, but they don't feel like it's important to tell us. Substance abuse and withdrawal delirium, heavy metals, toxins, cancer. Look at the probability of delirium versus age. Again, remembering our age here is 78. Look what happens at about 70 to the curve of delirium. Let's touch on neuropathogenesis. So in order to understand delirium, we're going to go through this slide in great detail. Some of you know me already, if you're laughing. So this is another famous Jose Maldonado from 2013 slide. This is how he thinks about delirium. He publishes an article, a review article, and quotes 150 authors, and they're all him. I mean, he owns majority of the real estate in delirium, and it's increasing because he's publishing so frequently. But he's kind of he's the guru of delirium. As you can tell by the slide, he's also a little odd. He's a very mysterious figure at conferences. He doesn't talk to people until he gives the presentation. There's a big mystique about him and what he does. But he's at Stamford, Connecticut, and he's very good, and he's very personable if you speak to him. I have. He's wonderful. So just a few words on neuropathogenesis. There are impaired neurotransmitters, and there's impaired neural circuitry, but it leads to a final pathway, which we call delirium. This final network involves regions and circuits that support consciousness and higher level of thinking. The dysfunction to impact delirium can occur in the cortical areas and subcortical areas. And on EEG, this is what we see as often diffuse slowing. In terms of final pathways, psychiatry functions in this final pathways concept. Something like schizophrenia, we don't know exactly what causes it, but there's a final pathway that impacts perceptual disturbance. There's cognitive change in schizophrenia, et cetera. So the final pathway concept is pretty engraved into psychiatry. I wrote down an example. I don't know if this will help. So if delirium is a symptom cluster, so it's like having anuria or oliguria, but you can't check for creatinine, fractional excretion, or do a biopsy of the kidney. You kind of have to extrapolate backwards. We don't have our version of creatinine when we see oliguria or anuria. So a lot of our diagnosis falls into the clinical realm. And with so much variation, it can be even challenging for psychiatrists. Acetylcholine is really where the money was and maybe where the money is, because it seems to be the most common, most identifiable problem with patients who are delirious. It has, with reduced cholinergic activity, that is suspected to be the best etiology for delirium. There are many things that can tie into the acetylcholine pathway. As you saw that chart, it gets very complicated. It may all boil down to acetylcholine at some point, indirectly or directly. And I put in parentheses here Benadryl. Benadryl is anticholinergic, the prototypical drug to cause delirium. The cholinergic system is involved in cortical activation, REM sleep, EEG fast waves, motor components of behavior, attention, learning, etc. Cholinergic activity is affected by hypoxia, hypoglycemia, and dementia. There are obviously other neurotransmitters involved. Dopamine, thought to be increased in delirium. GABA, increased or decreased. Cytokines, false neurotransmitters, quinolinic acid, interleukin, etc. There are many neurotransmitters. Think about that neural picture. So we can't just check for one of them. Moving on to financial impact and length of stay. This might be a bit surprising and to some of you, and this is why delirium matters, and this is maybe why delirium is not, should be spoken about more commonly, especially in the hospital setting from an administrative standpoint. In 2011, the cost to Medicare of delirium was $164 billion per year. The cost to the hospital was, on average, more than $11 billion per year. Pulse hospital costs $153 billion per year. These patients are rehospitalized. They have more ER visits. They're institutionalized. They're placed into rehabs. They get more home care services. There's more caregiver burden. These are stats for the U.S., by the way. Milbrandt did a study in 2004. This is a pretty decent study that was controlling for different variables that we can often say may not give us a clear result. Looking at the bottom there, the median ICU cost for a patient who was not delirious was $13,000, but if they were, it was $22,000. The total hospital cost for a non-delirious patient was $27,000, but if they were delirious, it was $41,000. And us using delirium in our everyday language as even non-clinicians, I think masks this even more. Length of stay. Starting from 2018 now, increased length of stay by 4 days. 1990, it was 5 to 10, and in 2003, it was by more than 7. In 2011, patients who were delirious in the ER stayed twice as long in the hospital when compared to non-delirious patients. So just imagine how many patients we're already getting in the ER who are delirious. Moving on to morbidity and mortality. So patients who are delirious, they have a functional and cognitive decline. They have increased rates of dementia. They are sicker. They're in institutions more. There's PTSD after delirium. There's caregiver burden. They poorly participate in PT and OT. They pull tubes, IVs, and catheters. These are all things that can not only contribute to their sickness, but also to their death. They can self-harm if they're very psychotic. They're disruptive. They have poor PO intake and failure to thrive. I don't think I've seen more than 2 failure to thrives in this hospital for the past 2 years that were not delirious. So delirium and failure to thrive are a very big thing together. These patients fall. They fall out of the bed. They fracture something. It further decreases their lifespan. Urinary incontinence, UTIs, poor performance in ADLs. They refuse medications. Patients sitting with systolics of 200 are refusing blood pressure meds because they're delirious. That's a consult that I see pretty frequently. So just to kind of summarize what the last few slides were, there's an increased risk of death of 4 to 65%. Increased risk of death for 4 to 65%. And there's an increased risk of death from 4 to 65%. As far back as 1990, patients who were delirious elderly in the acute medical setting were thought to have an 8% rate of mortality versus your 1%. There is also a long-term mortality. At three years, all the way down at the bottom of the slide, patients who were delirious were 75% more likely to die versus your 51%. This is from the HELP website. Dr. Auslander first pointed this out to me when I started here. This is the Elder Life Program. He goes to this pretty often. This is one of his main websites that he speaks about. It gives you a lot of very interesting literature. 1 out of every 3 physicians recognizes delirium. 1 out of every 3 nurses recognize delirium. And in literature, the recognition of delirium is associated with less mortality and shorter length of stay, and the converse is true as well. So these are your rating scales for delirium. There are many. I couldn't fit more onto this slide. They're pretty situation-specific, unit-specific, patient-specific. I think if you choose one, that's okay. There are some on here that you've probably seen. There are some on here that I have not seen. This is just a list of how many delirium scales there are. Some are very long. Some are also very short. The relationship to dementia. So this is an interesting, useful, and also, I think, complicated area for a clinician. In order to tell if a patient is delirious, and those who have rotated with me, you have to know if this is new or old. And often patients come in with such profound things, and we can't tell. You really cannot tell. There's no image or test that will tell you what's new and what's old in your dementia delirium assessment. So what is their cognitive baseline? Who was the patient 1 day ago, 1 week ago, 1 month ago? And that's all the clinical interview. So how do we figure out this cognitive baseline? So just one thing before you read this slide. I guess as a psychiatrist, I'll be a little bit more objective when I say I can't identify many of my family's problems. We are not able to see ourselves objectively in many ways. And patients and their families cannot see themselves objectively. So how do we figure out what's old and what's new by asking questions? So these are just some kind of launching questions just to speak about. So how long is your dad having difficulty with memory? Oh, they're fine. They always know. Dad, where were you born? You know, everybody goes to the remote memory from a long time ago. What kind of work did you do? You know, patients' families will always point out how strong our patients are cognitively. And then you have the family where the patient got the date wrong by one, and the family will say, look at them. They're terrible. They're psychotic. They're delirious. They're never coming back. So we have this large spectrum of patients' families that speak to us. So how long is dad having difficulty with memory? Is it 6 months? Is it 3 months? Is it a week? Is it a year? Dementias have a cognitive trajectory. And depending on which type of dementia it is, the trajectory can be a little bit different. When is the last time mom was like you and I? I like asking this question because it gives children of our patients a better perspective of what I'm looking for. And it allows you almost to go around the defensiveness and maybe the shame that their loved one is forgetful or hit a nurse overnight or something like that. When did you notice grandpa get worse? Was it sudden? Was it yesterday? Was it a month ago? Did grandma develop psychosis, mood agitation, suicidality, or homicidality? Or is it old? It's good to find the impairment and track its course. Could they count last week? Did they do their bills last week? If you give them a list for groceries, can they finish it? Can they get everything or will they forget? How long, when is the last time, whether a year or two ago, that they could actually complete a grocery list on their own? If you ask that, it's a little bit more, it's less intrusive and will maybe inflame families less if you ask questions like that rather than well, they don't know the date. When's the last time they knew the date? Well, culturally, that can affect people. But again, families and us, we're not good at telling our own issues objectively. So just a very basic slide on delirium dementia. So delirium is acute and subacute. Dementia is insidious. Delirium fluctuates. Consciousness, in whichever definition you look at it, dementia, actually, patients will first, if they have most basic dementias, they'll forget the date, and then the location, and then the name. But consciousness in delirium is impaired. They were perfect, like me and you last week, and today they don't know their name. Delirium. Attention and memory, there's a pattern to this as well. I'll come back to that in a second. Hallucinations and delusions. The psychotic realm can really fluctuate in both. It's hard to use psychosis to separate between delirium and dementia. But in dementia, they tend to be fixed and paranoid. And in delirium, they're vague. They're trying to kill me. Who? Well, everyone, you know. And dementia is, well, my husband of 47 years is trying to kill me and take my money. So it gets a little more specific in dementia, typically. I want to point out under attention and memory and the difference between the two, the long term in late stages of dementia. This is often a big clinical hint. If a patient knew their remote history, meaning where they're from, what country, their parents' names, and all of that, and they don't know it now, and the change is about a week or a month or even 3 to 6 months, you don't lose your remote memory in dementia right away. To lose your remote memory in most dementias takes a long time. So if your patient did not have any problems with remote memory, but now they do, that is a big flag for delirium. Because in delirium, they lose everything. It's all across the board. Driving is a big one. When's the last time they drove, by the way? And drove and did not get lost. Drove and the police were not called to find them. So the workup and differential diagnosis. In delirium, discovering the etiology is key. And treating the underlying etiology is the first step in treatment. I show this picture here because even if you remove the gasoline, meaning treat the underlying cause, the fire may or may not go out, meaning delirium. And if it does not go out, then it'll need treatment. This is just my suggestion, just looking at the literature and just combining clinically. I separate it in color in terms of how I'm thinking in different tiers. When I'm consulted and I see that the patient is delirious, I'm looking at where the team is up to. And I try to add in what either hasn't been ordered for a while or what hasn't been ordered yet. But pretty much this is your standard workup for delirium. Because you want to identify the cause, so we really want to hunt for the cause. I can give anyone any med that I can come up with, but if they have a continuous gasoline source onto the fire, I can push back against that with the meds a little bit, but the delirium will continue to be self-propelled. So identifying the cause is very important. And this doesn't really contain zebras and paraneoplastic syndromes, which we see as well. So non-pharmacologic treatment, this is huge for delirium. We don't often do it so routinely, so repeatedly. We're not as determined clinically to do this, but units that have done this see a tremendous decrease in delirium and decrease in meds, improvement in outcomes, decrease in morbidity and mortality, removing lines, correcting electrolytes, catheters, correcting sensory deficits, promoting normal circadian rhythms, lights, curtains, noise, environmental stimulation. If our repetitive Boca regional clip on the TV does not help you orient yourself. It orients you to location, but something like recent news, not old newspapers, new newspapers, and minimizing isolation, which can be difficult. So entering the pharmacologic area, we want to avoid anticholinergic medications. So you will see that I will stop benzos, which are GABA. We want to avoid those two, and Benadryl and Atarax. Those are drugs, those are easy fixes for me. When I see patients on these medications, I will quickly start stopping them. If you're on pain meds and you need Benadryl, you're in a bind. If you're on fentanyl intubated in ICU, you need Benadryl. There's a bit of a bind there. Adequately treating pain. Pain is a risk factor and etiology for delirium. And it's hard to tell when a patient who can't really tell us what hurts or what doesn't hurt, to realize what's agitation, what is pain. So it's sometimes easy to have, when we have dilaudid PRNs available and Haldol PRNs available, it's easier to give dilaudid sometimes. But opioids should be reserved really for pain, and sometimes splitting that differential is very hard. Moving on to symptom-targeted treatment with medication. So this is how we treat delirium. So this is another one of Jose Maldonado's slides. This is how he treats delirium, and he does it clinically. When on the left, you'll see the etiologies coming down, and on top are the neurotransmitters. He will combine cocktails of psychiatric drugs to target each receptor, to go against each receptor under each specific diagnosis. I don't think we're there yet. He's one of the few people who does this, and this is his approach. But this is a great slide because it shows you how complex different types of deliriums are. So some general treatment considerations. There's melatonin, there's Presidex, there's clonidine, there's Zofran, rivastigmine, Namenda, donepezil, amantadine, and Tylenol. Root is very important. Patients who are delirious, you can't say, time out, take this. They may not. They may be coming in with failure to thrive and not taking medications. They may not have a PO route. There's a patient now who's getting a spit fistula and has a floating esophagus on the floors. I mean, it's you know, you have to find a way to treat delirium in the patient who might not be able to accept or take PO. One thing here that I like to mention on this slide, clinically speaking, when we're thinking of symptom-targeted treatment, just one warning here. When I see rigidity and tremor on exam, I like to touch patients too, and I may touch one or two elbows, but I like to check for rigidity and tremor. Tremor is more visible, obviously, than rigidity. Because if a patient has Parkinson's or Lewy body dementia or alcohol withdrawal, the clinical treatment will have to be different. So because Lewy body and Parkinson's can literally die from antipsychotics. So when you're thinking of treating a patient, check them at the elbow, see if they have tremor, ask if they have Parkinson's. That'll help you to avoid unfortunate events with your choice. So in looking at the hyperactive, the agitated phenotype of delirium, we have different drugs. You can read them. I listed here the generic and the brands. What's most important to me about this slide is what's available IM and what's available IV. As you can see, we're very limited in terms of what we can give IV. And this is a problem because it's easier to push an IV on an agitated patient than it is to hold them down and stick their arm with a needle. No one likes that. So in terms of treating patients and treating agitation and why maybe we should treat in advance a little bit before things escalate too much, is we should consider the route. Our mood stabilizers are typically our cardiac-friendly drugs, but are also, they can cause hepatic failure. Some of them are renally dosed, like Neurontin. I use a lot of Depakote IV. I think we have carbamazepine IV, but Depakote is something that is very easy to kind of drive and causes fatigue. It can quickly bring down a patient who has a QTC of 600, and it's available IV. So the route is very important. And these are drugs, this is how we treat delirium in literature, not just drugs available by route. So for the hypoactive, this is historically a little bit harder to treat. We use Haldol, Risperdal, and Abilify. That's why you see me use Abilify. Abilify had an IM version, which made things a lot easier a couple of years ago, but they took it off the market. So now it's only, you know, my hypoactives in the SICU who have no PO route, we don't even have liquid Abilify. So it's very hard to treat a hypoactive. And so I'm left, just think of the process a little bit. Our hypoactive deliriums in the ICU, out of those three drugs, I'm left with only giving Haldol IV. And often these patients have cardiac issues and lung issues. So it's a very high risk process. Not that antipsychotics cause arrhythmias and et cetera. There is that risk, of course, when we monitor the QTs. But the limitations of what I can do, what we can do, is very small. We have other drugs for hypoactive delirium. Stimulants are really PO. Modafinil and Provigil, great drugs for delirium. I have to do prior auths when the patients leave when I give someone modafinil. I don't have a practice, so that's you know, a little bit time consuming, but if the patient needs it, they need it. Amantadine, bromocriptine, these are mostly PO medications. So again, the route is very important and often challenging to find in the hospital. One thing about treatment also is the treatment response time. Families often ask, how long will it be until they get better? It really varies. I can see a response in a day or two being very honed in on my mental status exam, but families will often notice a difference in maybe a week or so. So I often tell families it can be 5 to 7 days, but you may see something sooner. Okay, moving on to recovery. So delirium, by definition, is reversible. It requires treatment, and it takes weeks to months to formally recover. Many follow-up studies today show that delirium actually doesn't recover that well, and that cognitive impairment lasts for a very long time. I see some of the neurologists here quoting that it takes about 3 months for a patient to recover from delirium. That comes from a big review in the past 3 years, I believe, where it takes, again, 3 months for a patient to recover from delirium. That's a very long time. And these patients will recover if they do well, eat well, sleep well, that they have no more medical complications, they have no more readmissions, and there are no more medication changes. So how many patients can you think of that will do that well, problem-free, for so long? It's a tall order for patients to really come out. And even treating their UTIs, their mental status really is kind of climbing a rock wall for the next 3 months. And many patients, as you've seen, do not really make it. So the new literature in delirium is that it really may not be so reversible. It's, you know, every time you drop, meaning the delirium, it comes back to a lower baseline. And it's ironic in psychiatry that delirium is starting to create this curve, because our bipolars and our schizophrenics create this curve too. Every time you have an episode, patients say, well, who cares if I'm manic or psychotic, or, you know, I created 3 apps and I'm a multimillionaire and I live in Boca now. But your cognition eventually drops, and that's what the studies in other psychiatric conditions show. And that's where delirium seems to be headed as well, because and it's sad, because when I was a resident in fellowship, we kind of looked at a few articles, but when I was a resident, delirium was reversible. You give him some Haldol, you treat the UTI, grandpa's going to get better. And we would say that to families, but now the literature is really showing that they may not be coming. And we see that clinically. You hear that patients come in for UTI, they never quite were the same again, then they came in for respiratory failure, and then they came in for UTI, and then they're very far from where they were 6 months ago. Is that dementia now? Is that delirium? The lines are a little bit blurred now. In terms of psychiatric medications, I always point this out to those who rotated with me, because this is kind of a humbling slide, I think, for us as doctors. So metoclopramide, Reglan, is a dopamine antagonist that we give to children, pregnant women, and elderly for nausea. We use this medication all the time. This medication is an antipsychotic that prolongs the QT, causes metabolic syndrome, and that causes tardive dyskinesia, but we often do not talk about this. Prochlorperazine or Compazine is the same. We give it for nausea all the time, sometimes with Reglan. Phenergan is our third out of the three that we give for nausea here. Dopamine blocker, created in the 1940s. Droperidol, we give for nausea and for migraines. These are drugs that we give all the time that are antipsychotics, and I'm speaking to the stigma of antipsychotics. We use these in pregnant women and children, and no one ever discusses side effects. So just something to consider. So in terms of side effects, this big black box warning for antipsychotics. So I wanted to just show you exactly what it is and just share some thoughts with you on it. So this was a collection of studies that showed an increased risk of death over 10 weeks, and the death was 2.6% in the placebo group, and it was 4.5% in the treatment group. Death occurred because of cardiovascular causes and because of infectious causes, and they concluded that there is a 1.6 to 1.7 times the risk of death in placebo patients compared to the antipsychotic. So the antipsychotic patients have a higher risk of death. But look at the black box warning on top. It says dementia with psychosis. This lecture is on delirium. Different. Look at the death due to infectious causes. The deaths that showed up in these studies were secondary to pneumonia. Can antipsychotics cause pneumonia? Possibly, if they oversedate someone. But as you can see, heart failure, these patients were sick, they were elderly, and they died, and antipsychotics were involved. So do antipsychotics increase risk of death in dementia with psychosis? Possibly. Few more comments about this black box warning. The patients were very ill. Agitation can be variable. This was a 10-week trial, collection of average of 10-week trials. But we use sometimes antipsychotics for a couple of days. And what we are treating are not always dementia with psychosis. 80% of dementia has behavioral issues. So technically, you can have behavior meaning psychosis. But this might be a different population, and this often is. Dementia with psychosis, the first line of treatment is usually antidepressants. Something like Celexa is probably the most common one started in literature. But we are treating in the hospital agitated, delirious patients who are combative. They may have dementia with psychosis, they may not. We may not know. So the black box warning that we are very afraid of was in a group of elderly sick people who died from things like pneumonia, and it may not have been dementia with psychosis. So in terms of the black box warning, if I have a dementia with psychosis patient that I'm starting an antipsychotic, I will speak about this loosely with the family as much as they can understand. But I tell them that this may have been a different population altogether. Antipsychotics can cause extrapyramidal symptoms. They can cause metabolic syndromes, EKG abnormalities, pancreatitis, etc. I really do tell families that antipsychotics, and I do talk about this, they can cause anything from headache to death. But really, the benefits and the risks are what are important at the time. So one final thought. Is there a safer way to address acute agitation and or psychosis in the elderly with delirium and dementia? How do we treat their appetite? How do we treat their sleep? How do we treat their sadness? And please consider the route when thinking of the answer to this question. Are you going to do it PO, IM, or IV? So hence the dilemma in the hospital. I think that's it. Go ahead.
Two questions.
Sure.
The first one is it seems like we're back in the future. Dr. Rubin and I, when we trained in the late 80s and 90s, if you gave anybody Halidol, you could pretty much get your ass kicked in a morning report in the morning because they thought you were going to kill your patients. Now we're saying we're going to do that, whereas previously in the 60s and 70s, antipsychotics came out. That was a routine care in the hospital for somebody who's delirious and agitated. So
sure. So regarding the first one, I can only speak for what my mentors taught me. And one of them was Arthur Rifkin, who was one of the pioneers in neuroleptization, where they gave patients 10 of Haldol, 10 of Haldol, 10 of Haldol, 10 of Haldol, until the patient really got better. And he has studies in the 1,000 milligram range for schizophrenia, and they had no side effects. So there's also that. It's hard for me to convince you that antipsychotics are helpful as a psychiatrist, but I can offer you the other options and say, what else are you choosing from? Because if you give Ativan or Benadryl, the things often given IV and IM, the patients will get worse. We can do nothing, but again, I'm going to personally make the argument that waiting for a patient to get better, they're stuck here, they're coming back, they're losing it in the nursing home, families are distressed. So timing, you know, when I get a failure to thrive who's 85, timing is a very big thing. Days mean something. So I was taught about the stigma about drugs and psychiatry from my mentors, but today it's hard to see a patient get better with my medication and not want to do it again. And to see families' responses and see the doctors be able to discharge the patient who was not dischargeable. So I think antipsychotics are hard to ignore, especially in the medical setting. Regarding the second question about, the stereotype of being a bad doctor, delirium comes, it's self-propelled, I'm young in terms of medicine, but I do understand that why insurance and clinical work really is separated. Families can't see the creatinine, but they can see that your patient's not better mentally. They're not talking to them. So the mental status, we often almost accept that it's less and that it's impacted. But I would say that it's almost an obstacle to our relationship with patients, families, and the patient getting better. The irony that psychiatrists joke about is that you can't excise psychiatry from a medical setting. You just can't, because your patients will get delirious, confused, and combative, and whether we like it or not. So I think it's not about of course I don't think we are bad doctors, but it's a very easy thing to pinpoint for a family to say, well, look, he came in here on his two feet and he's coming out in a wheelchair. And the patient can't stand up, and that's very easy to identify for patients, families. I don't know if that helps. Go ahead.
Yeah, so two things. Number one, you get called to see a lot of these patients to do endoscopic procedures, right? They get Diprovan. And if you have someone who has underlying dementia, and you give them Diprovan, they may not wake up for a few days. And when they do wake up, they're not the same. They're not back to the baseline. So oftentimes to put in a peg, and the indications are kind of borderline, so it's just something to think about when some internist or someone calls for a peg, because the Diprovan may not get them back to their baseline and just exacerbate an underlying problem. And the other thing is, too, a lot of experience with phenothiazines, and I think it's an exceedingly high threshold for anyone getting a phenothiazine over 70, because we do see significant mental status changes, delirium, and lethargy in people who are not
taking a long time to come back to the baseline. Right. And I agree, and even, pegs, we did a palliative rotation in our fellowship, and one of the first things we learned was pegs were not going to really change things significantly. And now introducing the fact that just to place a peg, they need to be sedated, how much more risk could there be? And it's hard because, the doctor's done with the peg, the patient's wheeled out, SICU, MICU, they have the same mentality, patient's sleeping as they're wheeled out. Then they wake up and the length of stay just blows up on the floors from a simple procedure. I get called to see elective cases that came in with no primaries, just done by the person who did the elective procedure, and all of a sudden they're here for 3 weeks because of sedation. And it's, but we do pegs and we do other things. Both, actually, both. Both.
The other question I had is, you see a lot of patients on Seroquel, Benadryl, all these meds that they're put on for sleep. I just have a problem with that, because it just seems like overkill. I don't know what your opinion is on using antipsychotics and strong antidepressants for chronic sleep.
It's a great question. Antipsychotics for sleep there's a stigma now for antipsychotics for sleep because of mostly non-psychiatric physicians. it's hard to, the patient themselves, when they come into your office and they complain of sleep issues as a primary, as a specialist, it's hard to get them out of the office. If you can't sleep, you can't function. Without sleep, 3 days, we can start hallucinating, and that would be okay. So sleep is a very kind of cardinal thing we as humans like to do. So sleep, you know, that's why benzos are so often used in the elderly. That's why antipsychotics are used. Seroquel is mostly used by primaries for sleep, not by psychiatrists. We often may tag another diagnosis with it. But it is a problem. The TCAs, they're anticholinergic. You know, there's small dose studies in doxepin in the elderly, but it's only a brand. I think it's called Cinequan or something like that. You know, they did those studies for like a 10 milligram dose of doxepin. It's an anticholinergic drug for sleep in the elderly, but we can use a generic 25 and try to split it. So did they really skew the literature when they tried to sell Cinequan as an anticholinergic for sleep in the elderly? You know, there's a lot of tangled wire here, but they're used all the time because patients want to sleep. And as a doctor, sometimes you want to give naturally. You want to give something to your patients. It's hard not to give. We give all day long.
You made the inference that cognition is seemingly declining. Two quick questions. Is delirium a precondition for some people to get demented? And secondly, should we be starting delirious patients on anticholinesterase inhibitors more frequently for the purpose of preventing future cognitive decline?
So in terms of the first question, the more we think or talk, psychiatry likes the word prodrome. There's a prodrome to everything in psychiatry. The more we introduce things like prodromes and syndromes, pre-delirium, post-dementia, the spectrum kind of widens, and it's hard. How close clinically are they? We're not going to biopsy brains to diagnose the two. And if we did, what would they show anyway? So it's very hard, I think, to... The more literature comes out, the more maybe vague delirium and dementia gets, especially when you have this delirium like I showed in that slide that never really comes back to baseline. So is that like your dementia now? If it's lasting for 7 months, you know, we have patients who are in and out of the hospital for a year. Which one is that? And I don't know. It gets very vague. And just remind me your second question. I'm sorry. So that's an interesting question. Even though acetylcholine is where the money is, it's actually, if you give everyone those drugs, they don't necessarily get better. So things like rivastigmine, galantamine. Interestingly enough, Lewy body dementia with psychosis, rivastigmine is an indication for that. And it comes in a patch too. So I do that on the floors. But outside of really Lewy body with psychosis, or in a patient with too much of a patient who needs Benadryl with too little acetylcholine, that I need to rev it up a little bit because clinically I'm kind of stuck. I may give him some rivastigmine, but outside of like a direct acetylcholine deficit or Lewy body psychosis, those drugs really are not helpful clinically in delirium. They're in the literature. But they're not as helpful. And prophylaxis-wise, clinically, if I give someone one of Haldol before a hip repair, most likely they'll get better. But the studies don't support that. Studies don't support pre-medication for delirium before surgeries or anything like that yet. Sure. Ketamine really lives in the ICUs with EMS and in the ER. That's where the literature is coming from. I think most of it's from the ER as well. Now ICU is catching up. I don't think we understand ketamine that well. And I've used it maybe 5 times here in the hospital. And maybe it's something of the future. You know, we're treating depression in clinics IV with ketamine for $1,000 a treatment. You can get a you can lift your depression and you get it twice a week or whatever. But I don't think we know enough about ketamine, especially being a drug, meaning a street drug too. I don't know, but we've done some interesting work together with ketamine in the ER, and I don't know if they're much worse after they wake up. I don't know if there's that decrease. I don't know if there's a minus with ketamine. The vital signs in terms of the literature are pretty solid. I mean, you know, bradycardia, or, you know, but that's really it. I mean, these patients were very resilient that were shown in the literature in terms of their vital signs with ketamine. I don't. Such a hot topic. No, I'd. All right. Thanks, guys.